Welcome to Lush and our first ever Key Words. Storytelling is at the very heart of inspiring others, and Key Words aims to combine traditional storytelling with a keyword, that hugely significant thing which propels a story with passion and purpose. This pilot program was recorded in Poole in Lush's offices at the Dolphin Keys and is introduced by Lush's Andrew Payne.
Hello and welcome to Key Words. My name is Andrew Payne and I'll be introducing today's storyteller. Our stories might suggest a better future, describe a magnificent failure, inform an action, offer a reflection, or inspire you to tell your own stories. We all have irresistible stories to tell. Thank you for coming along and listening to one of them. Today's guest is Charlie Moores, producer of Lush Audio Content, and his key phrase for today's story is a small hole. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Charlie Moores.
Hello, thanks for coming. As Andrew said, my name's Charlie Moores and I make Lush Audio Content, which has nothing whatsoever to do with the story I'm going to tell. So, intro's over. As Andrew said, my key word, a small hole. Right, so I'm a bird watcher, or a birder as we normally refer to ourselves, because that sounds a little more action man than someone who sits around watching birds. And in fact, this is quite an action-packed story, even if it is about birds, or partly about birds. And it begins in 1985, which I realise is prehistory for many of you here today, and certainly pre-mobile phones, pre-Facebook and Google Maps, of course. But in 1985... I was pretty much obsessed with birds, and I was spending a lot of time twitching, which is basically driving a stupid amount of miles every weekend to see a bird that should be somewhere else but had got lost, headed the wrong way on migration perhaps, or joined a flock of similar birds that were headed for the UK anyway, which ended up on some little island or a headland or a tree where it looked quizzically at the huge numbers of grown men queuing up to see it before it either died, got eaten by a sparrowhawk, or very occasionally reorientated and flew back to where it had come from. Now, I had some incredible times twitching. I went all the way to the Shetlands to see an albatross. I stood with hundreds of other action men in a supermarket car park in Kent to look at a small warbler that should have been in Central America. I went all over the place. But the best place, my favourite place, were the Isles of Scilly, the magic isles, 40 kilometres southwest of Land's End. These barely inhabited islands were where lost birds from America might end up in the same bush as lost birds from Siberia. Hundreds and hundreds of went every autumn. The right winds seemed to drop rare birds out of the sky, and we ran about all day, every day to see them. I just remember October's back then being all about running up lanes, over hills, onto headlands, round fields, down paths, wherever a bird was found, and I had to get there before it flew off. It was amazing fun, but in reality, me and everyone else was running to see birds that were fantastically unusual in the UK, but that were actually fairly common in America or Siberia or wherever they should have been after migration, and where they stayed in more or less one place until the spring. Which are the thoughts that eventually led to a late night conversation in a pub on Scilly where three of us, and I'm not going to name the other two for reasons that will become apparent because they're quite well-known birdwatchers, made a slightly tipsy decision. A decision to go find these amazing birds where they were common. Where would we go? India and Nepal, the Himalayas. And we would go in January, in just 3 months' time, and we would come back 3 months later. Three birders who barely knew each other would plane, train, and automobile around a subcontinent we knew nothing about, except that it was full of birds, and we needed to see them. Birds like the almost mythical Siberian ruby-throat. Birds that we hadn't even heard of yet, but we had to see. Now, one thought that may have occurred to you is, how would my partner react if I told them I was going to have a 3 months holiday and that I was going to go in 3 months' time? While some of you might think, now that I've brought it up, that it seems highly unlikely that grown men who chase birds around the country would have to worry about what their partners thought, because it seems highly unlikely they would have had partners in the first place, that's understandable, but wrong. All three of us did indeed have partners. I'm not sure how unusual that made us at the time, but we did, and mine was very lovely, and I hoped she'd understand and be very happy for me. Happy that I was doing something incredible and once in a lifetime, that I'd be seeing all these birds, and I was wrong. She wasn't happy at all. In fact, she was extremely not happy at all. It turns out that doing something spectacularly selfish like going abroad for 3 months to watch birds is, in the opinion of some girls anyway, spectacularly selfish. Anyhow, January came around and off we went. And as I say, this was in an era long before mobile phones and the internet. If you burnt your bridges before you went away for 3 months, you could either accept the reality of coming back to the UK as a single man, or live in hope that absence really does make the heart grow fonder. And I'll leave you to think on the likely outcome. In the meantime, for three blokes who really didn't know each other and were having to use sheets of paper with directions printed on them and pages ripped out of books to get around, we were doing rather well. We'd been to see the Taj Mahal, not many birds, so we didn't stay long. We'd found Siberian ruby throats. We'd taken an amazing train ride almost all the way to the Pakistan border, where we'd birded in the Thar Desert and seen the most incredible night sky, where the stars looked liquid, like they were hung on sparkling threads. And we'd somehow stayed out of trouble. We'd not been run over by some of the loopiest drivers we'd ever encountered. We'd not left our binoculars in what passed for the hotels we'd been collapsing into at night. And by the end of February, we'd seen so many birds, we'd filled notebooks. Become a touch blasé about seeing squadrons of vultures leaving city walls in the morning and almost tuned out the constant sound of car horns. And we'd headed into the mighty Himalayas. The Himalayas are immense. The Lake District, it's a hump in the road. The mountains of Scotland and Wales, not much more than hills. The Himalayas reach up to the sky and seem to go right through it. They're wild. They're dangerous. They're nothing like we'd ever seen before. And unbelievably, they are full of birds. Mountain birds are different. They're hardy and they glide on icy winds, plunge into icy rivers, sing from the tops of icy rocks and scuttle about beneath icy bushes. And they have amazing names like Stolitzer Tit Warbler, Grandula, Rusty Flank Tree Creeper. Of course, we timed our trip so that much of the ice had already melted. The nights were cold, really cold, but the days were just joyous. I'll never forget arriving in a village after dark and not really being able to see very much, and then stepping outside in the morning to realise we were on the edge of the most magnificent snow-capped peaks that looked so close you could reach out and dig your fingers into the snow. Peaks that ran into more peaks that in all likelihood ran into even more peaks that no one had even ever walked upon. And more than that, we'd climbed up into the realm of another group of birds that we were desperate to see. The mountain pheasants. Now, pheasants might seem like an odd thing to get excited about, but most pheasants are absolutely stunning. The pheasant we all know, the one seen tumbling out of the sky to the clink of champagne glasses, is actually a beautiful bird. It originally comes from Asia, where it lives in grasslands with scattered trees. Sure, we now see pheasants all over the place, but imagine seeing something that dazzling, that beautiful, up in the Himalayas. Incredibly exotic pheasants, like the Western tragopan and the remarkable Himalayan monal. The national bird of Nepal, a rainbow-coloured tank of a pheasant, weighs more than a large turkey and stands 6 feet high at least. It's not that big, of course, but in that environment, in that habitat, it rules. And we were desperate to see one well. We'd seen a couple exploding off outcrops and wheeling away into the valleys, and they were magnificent, but we wanted to see them well. And to do that, we had to stay in the right place overnight, a tiny village with a few houses and one small hostel, then walk miles uphill and keep really quiet. Now, while we had survived well so far, it's relevant to say that one of us had developed a rather nasty, chesty cough, and that we were walking a well-trodden path that trekkers had long ago nicknamed the Andrex Trail because of the frequent piles of toilet paper that marked the point at which said trekkers had been unable to keep hold of the load of rice, lentils, and whatever else they'd managed to find to eat. We three had been determined from the outset not to add to these environmentally unpleasant cairns. So far, we'd been pretty good. We'd been going off trail and digging small holes, hiding our business away in the long grass, as it were. And why am I telling you this? Because the next day, the three of us woke at dawn and headed high into the hills above the village, into a sea of grass with scattered trees and scree slopes and ridges and monal pheasants. Now, I mentioned that one of us, and I'm not going to say which one of us, had a bit of a chesty cough, and some of the stuff he was producing was just weird. We should have saved some of it for study, but we still had a month to go, and well, who wants to carry that around for 4 weeks? So there we were, high above the village, thigh deep in dry grass, keeping as quiet as possible, scanning the ridges for monal pheasants, when one of us, again, I'm not saying which one of us, decides to blow their nose. And being environmentally responsible, even then, back in the 80s, he looks around to decide where to put the tissue. Now, you probably know what you might have done in such a situation. Pristine habitat, rare birds, a very long way from home. Dig a small hole, probably. What you probably wouldn't do, if you'd given it much thought, is to pull out a box of matches and set fire to the tissue to destroy it permanently. You'd probably not do that because it's almost impossible to hold onto a tissue while it burns, because a tissue is not a particularly solid item, and it typically hangs downwards, meaning the flames come up towards your hand, and flames hurt. Which is what one of us, etc., etc., appreciated just seconds later, as with a yelp of pain, burning paper met tender skin. Now, I'm here to tell you that should you ever be standing in a sea of dry grass in a rare and valuable habitat looking for a pheasant that depends on that habitat, what you don't want to do is drop a burning tissue onto it. And if you do that, what you then don't want to do is take an item of clothing, like a sweater, say, and bring that item down from above your head onto what's left of that just burning tissue, because of the force of the air your sweater pushes out in front of it, will work something like giving the kiss of life to a dying man. There is, as we all probably know, nothing which revives fire more quickly than a gust of wind. Especially, it appears, when that gust of wind is delivered by a frantic birder who is just realising that he has done something incredibly stupid. We went in seconds from a rather daft thing to do to setting fire to a hillside in the Himalayas. The fire exploded out from under the incoming sweater and leapt into the waiting grass with a whoop and a crackle, with the vigour of a pheasant exploding off a rock. We were literally standing in what Johnny Cash would have described as a ring of fire. And there was nothing, absolutely nothing we could do except run. Away from the birds this time, but when you're running for your life, which is how it seemed to us, that really doesn't matter. We ran and we ran, and I'm still not sure how it happened, but at one point we actually met flames coming up the hill in the direction we were running down. It was pretty scary. At some point we remembered that grass fires don't actually burn that hot. Forest fires will roast you alive, but grass fires not so much. And they tend to burn along a front. If you hold your nerve, you can run through the flames and into the ash and the soot on the other side, which is what we did. And we ran all the way to the village, hoping, and I'm not religious, but praying that the fire wouldn't reach the houses wouldn't trap people, wouldn't destroy whole families. We got lucky, or more likely, the villagers had long ago got used to the fact that occasionally grasslands catch fire and had made sure their houses and their animals were safe behind fire breaks. No one died. Well, a little bit of each of us died. The parts that had been congratulating ourselves on so far staying out of trouble and doing nothing stupid on our big adventure. But I will never forget sitting in the village that night, watching narrow lines of orange and red snaking up the surrounding hills, smelling smoke, listening to the crackling, trying to avoid the eyes of villagers who suspected we were responsible, but weren't asking because, truth be told, they liked fresh grass for their livestock, but they'd been banned from setting fires in the old dead grass because of the importance of the grasslands to pheasants and mammals and other villagers. The next day, we climbed in silence back up the hill to see how far the fire had burned. We got up really high, high enough to see fold after fold after fold of hillside, and all of them were blackened and burnt. Those hills stretched away so far that, for all I know, our fire is still burning. It was utterly horrible. The grass was gone, the scattered trees were gone, the pheasants were gone. We were miles and miles away from home. What I would have given for a mobile phone and a 4G mast that night, but that was a hole I'd already dug and a bridge I'd burnt months before. And that's my story. And before I finish, I suppose I should tell you what I think the moral of this sorry tale is. There are several. Your mother was right. Never play with matches. Things don't always look better the next morning. Good intentions do not always have good consequences. And if you're going to get something off your chest, you're going to do something really stupid. It's far better to dig a small hole than set fire to an entire mountain. Thank you.
Keywords with me, Charlie Moores. Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to hear more from Lush, and our ever-growing archive contains interviews, debates and stories with a wide range of charities, organisations and individuals, please download the free Lush Player app, which is available for both Android and Apple.